This webcast is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Steinway & Sons is a proud sponsor of the ASCAP Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson broadcast award-winning program Between the Keys, featuring Jed Distler. More information about Steinway & Sons, makers of handcrafted pianos since 1853, is available at www.steinway.com. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and welcome to Between the Keys. We just heard the concluding gigue from the Partita No. 1 in B flat major by J.S. Bach, and that was a live performance with one of the most beloved of all 20th century pianists, Dinu Lipati. It was recorded on September 16, 1950, during Lipati's last concert. And he died at the age of 33, yet he had long been respected by both the general public and his own colleagues for the refinement and the maturity and the depth that he brought to his piano interpretations. My friend and colleague Mark Ainley has devoted a lot of time and research to the life and artistry of Dinu Lipati. He has written extensively about Lipati, as well as helped to bring many previously unknown or unpublished Lipati recordings to light, while also shattering more than a few urban myths about Lipati along the way. His Facebook page, Mark Ainley's Piano Files, is a rich source of recordings, videos, and information about history's piano legends, and it has thousands and thousands of followers all over the world, including myself. Mark Ainley and I met at my studio this past April 2018, and our conversation covered way, way too much ground for just one program. So this evening, I'm going to share the portion of our interview that covers Mark Ainley's research into the artistry of Dinu Lipati, and also the recent discovery of previously unknown Lipati recordings that now have been published for the first time. But before we get to my interview with Mark Ainley, let's hear Dinu Lipati play music of Franz Liszt, the Sonetto number 104 after Petrarca, from the Année de Pèlerinage, The Years of Wandering, Book 2. Dinu Lipati at the piano.
Thank you.
music of Franz Liszt, the Sonetto No. 104 after Petrarca from the Année de Pèlerinage, Book 2. The pianist was Dinu Lapati in a studio recording from September 24, 1947. Let's now go to my interview with the Dinu Lapati scholar and piano historian, Mark Ainley. Enjoy. Mark Ainley, welcome to Between the Keys. I'm so happy you're here.
I'm delighted to be here.
We all have our epiphanies about how we discovered so-called, quote-unquote, dead pianists. But I think to put it more nicely, we'd have to say a historic pianist or great pianist from the past. And there's an interview online where you talk about discovering a particular recording of the Beethoven Variations.
I was in my mid-teens, I was learning the Beethoven 32 Variations. And this is, the story that you read about, when I bought a record to try to listen to maybe how it should be played. And I bought this record, and right away my sense was, well, maybe this isn't how I would want to play it.
What didn't you like about it? Do you remember?
I found it a bit heavy and slow. I just sort of felt there should be a bit more zip, a bit more life.
Uh-huh.
And my teacher's first comment, in addition to not liking the playing, was, wow, look how thin that record is. It was a super thin record. And she said, come take a look at my 78s in the closet. And we go to her hallway closet, and she said, I'm sure I've got a Horowitz recording on 78 of the Beethoven 32 Variations. And in fact, she couldn't find it, but just looking at these thick 78s, I was intrigued and had heard, you know, I had in my mind that vision of dusty old, you know, scratchy old records.
But you hadn't seen one before.
I might have seen them, but I'd never played any.
Uh-huh.
And it was when she handed down an album with Rachmaninoff's hands, those beautiful hands on the cover, and I read the words, Rachmaninoff plays Rachmaninoff. I just had this epiphany of the fact that some composers might have recorded their own works, and I had no idea when recording technology started. And it's like, maybe did Beethoven record any of his own music? Did Chopin? I had no clue what the chronology was. And I could imagine cylinders and so on, but I didn't know when the technology started. That's when I decided to start exploring.
And what did you think of the Rachmaninoff playing Rachmaninoff? Did you took the recording home?
Took that recording home. My parents had a turntable, an old dual turntable that could also play 78s. And I recorded it on cassette, and I soon figured out, oh, wow, the music runs out and I have to splice in the next section. And I soon got quite proficient at that.
That's probably why you became a DJ later on.
That's right.
Mixing 78s.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Mixing 78s was my
introduction. I know we're jumping ahead
introduction.
A little bit to your DJ life.
Yeah, I mean, 78s was it.
Yeah,
I definitely developed pretty good mixing technique.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then, you know, I started finding, oh, look, these are transferred onto LP. And I started going to, you know, record libraries. And there was a record lending library in Montreal. So that's where I came across, you know, Schnabel, and started getting more Lapati recordings.
Arthur Schnabel and Dinu Lapati. You are arguably the world's leading expert on the Romanian pianist and composer Dinu Lapati. You have written many notes accompanying reissues of his piano recordings, and you also have rediscovered recordings of his that we didn't know existed, or we sort of knew they existed. I'd like you to tell me how you discovered him in the first place.
When I got into these recordings at that time that it was describing, I was about 15 or 16. There was no internet. It was very happenstance in terms of how one would find things. And so I got Harold C. Schoenberg's book, The Great Pianists, which started putting into words some of the qualities of the playing that we couldn't hear in some of these old recordings. And so every Saturday and Sunday, go around the secondhand stores of Montreal with a list of names, and I would start recognizing which labels and which covers would probably represent something historical, and I would recognize some names and buy these records for $2 or $3 each, usually. Lapati, I actually didn't find yet, because Harold C. Schoenberg only had one sentence in his first edition of the book, of The Great Pianist. Lapati was basically had a parenthetical sentence where he just said that his because of his short life, his illness took away somebody who would have been a major figure in 20th century pianism.
But wasn't he already a major figure?
Well, this is it. So, you know, his terminology, he really did expand. To give him credit, he did expand on Lipati in his second edition of the book. Uh-huh. And what he says, actually, I'm hoping we'll be able to get to later on in terms of, I think, the perception in North America versus in Europe of Lipati's playing for several reasons. The first record I came across of Lipati was in my high school music library, where I was going through the very small selection of records that they had, and there was an Angel Records sampler that had tracks from different Angel Records releases. Oh, and there was a Schubert Impromptu, which I was also learning at the time, the E-flat. It said, "From Dinu Lipati's Last Recital." And I thought, well, that's a pretty morbid title. I had no idea what this was about. And I was intrigued, because of course, it's a very intriguing kind of sounding title. So I asked my high school band teacher, "Who is this Dinu Lipati?" And she said, "Oh, he was a pianist's pianist. Everybody loved Lipati." And so I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I found we had the record of the Grieg and Schumann in the library there. So I took that home. And I didn't really have the ears to recognize exactly what was going on in terms of the playing. But, you know, I thought it was very nice. Although there was something in the Schubert that he did, which was, you know, very different from, I thought, from what was in the text. And it attracted my attention. But I started buying Lipati's records in secondhand stores. And the Bach really caught my attention, because there was such clarity and precision.
Which Bach?
The Bach Partita and the Chorale. And the Chorales, yeah.
Yes.
Those are some of the recordings that he's most known for. But the epiphany came when somebody lent me a European pressing of a Lipati record, which had his only recording of Ravel, the Alborada del Grazioso, this incredible virtuoso work. And these glissandi that he just tears through. There was such incredible virtuosity and control, but this was so at odds with the perception of Lipati that I was reading about in all of the notes accompanying these records, about how he's this frail, sick pianist and this so sick at his last recital that he couldn't play the last of the Chopin waltzes, and he recorded so little because he was so sick. And I listened to this recording and I thought, well, he certainly doesn't sound sick there. And at the time, I was also getting interested in bootleg recordings. There were these record labels that would put out radio recordings that were not commercially approved of concerts. And so at the time, there was, you know, the Bruno Walter Society and Opus mm-hmm. Records. And I thought at the time, well, there certainly must be some Lipati recordings, because he died in 1950. So there certainly must be radio broadcasts from the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. And none of them turned up. I decided, well, I should start researching this myself. And I started writing to European radio stations and exploring. And I really was surprised at, given when he lived, how difficult it was to find extant recordings of this great pianist.
Although there were some radio broadcasts that were officially published after he died.
That's right. So, and it was quite a hunt. And so the more research I did in subsequent years, it was fascinating to hear what was happening behind the scenes. And there was a famous story, of course, of a Chopin concerto broadcast that was released. And it later turned out that, in fact, for 15 years, the EMI had released and circulated a recording which actually wasn't of Lipati, even though people close to him thought it was a recording of Lipati, and mm-hmm. eventually an authentic tape in 1981 was found and released.
Thank you.
Music by Maurice Ravel, that was Alborada del Grazioso from the piano suite Miroir with pianist Dinu Lapati. That is a studio recording made on April 17, 1948 for the EMI label, and we heard it in a fresh restoration from an original shellac pressing provided to me by our featured guest this hour, Mark Ainley, with whom I spoke a few months back. In a moment, we will return to my conversation with the writer, scholar, and producer Mark Ainley. But first, let me remind you that you are listening to Between the Keys, and I'm your host, Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network. Let's hear another example of pianist Dinu Lapati live in concert. Here is an encore from the concert that took place in February 1950 when Lapati played Chopin's first concerto. This is Chopin's Etude in E minor, opus 25, number 5, Dinu Lapati.
Thank you.
A live recording by pianist Dinu Lipati of Chopin's Etude in E minor, Opus 25, number 5. Let's return to my conversation with historian and producer Mark Ainley, who is one of the world's leading experts on the life and career and the artistry of pianist Dinu Lipati. As I mentioned earlier, a group of 5 previously unpublished Dinu Lipati recordings have recently been issued for the first time and are available on a release from the Marston label entitled Landmarks of Recorded Pianism, Volume 1, which contains numerous rare piano recordings, including other previously unpublished items with pianists like Alfred Cortot, Vladimir Horowitz, and Guillaume Novais, among others. The discovery of the unissued Dinu Lipati recordings, however, adds up to a real detective story, and Mark Ainley tells us this story in detail in the interview, and I hope you will find it interesting. Now, before I play this part of the interview, let me fill you in on a few details about two gentlemen that Mark mentions. One is Gregor Benko, who has made major contributions in preserving and disseminating historic piano recordings for more than half a century. And the same can be said for Alan Evans. Well, maybe not a half a century with Alan Evans. And Alan happens to be one of my oldest and closest friends. We were actually roommates when I first moved to New York back in the late 70s. Anyway, Alan Evans is the author of the biography of the legendary romantic pianist Ignaz Friedman, and he has reissued numerous rare treasures in both classical and world music on his own Arbiter label. So here is Mark Ainley and myself again, recorded at my New York studio in April of 2018. You were responsible, I think, for spearheading the release of 5 previously unpublished Dinu Lipati recordings that are just out in a release called Landmarks of Recorded Pianism, Volume 1 on the Marston label. And maybe you can talk about this because this seems like a real detective story.
You know, when I got into researching Lipati stuff in the late 80s, it really became such a detective story. And I could probably write just a spy story-like book about the hunt for these Lipati recordings. And this particular situation you're talking about is a fascinating one. And I also want to highlight that I didn't do this alone. All of my research as well, there have been so many key players who have helped me to further this Lipati work. And in this case as well, there are several other people who need to be acknowledged for what it is that they did to help this happen. So while my name is very much attached to the discovery of Lipati recordings, I've always had many people who've been helping and supporting me and getting me in the right place at the right time. In early 2008, I got an email from Alan Evans, which had in the subject header, "Mission Impossible?" question mark. And he said, there's a man in Brooklyn who, it appears, has some private Lipati recordings. Would he give me a call? So I called Alan up, and he told me that this man had apparently cleared out an estate in Geneva. He would go around and he would buy things from estates after people had passed away and resell, redistribute them. And among them were these, apparently, some recordings of Lipati that had his signature on the labels. And Alan wasn't having much luck with this fellow in convincing him to digitize the records. So he said, perhaps I would be able to speak with him and convince him. So I got the man's number, phoned him up, told him my interest. I said, you know, my interest is really musical. And of course, I would want you to be able to get whatever it is that you can to get these records out, to get you paid, etc. And I said, you know, perhaps I'd have an opportunity to see you if I go to New York. And he said, please do. A few months later, I did end up going to New York. I did this quite top secret because I wanted to have a very clean entry to see this man on my own, I thought. But I was staying with Gregor Benko while I was visiting New York. And the next day we were going to see Ward Marston, the transfer engineer who's responsible for the release of now of these recordings, but also of many other great historical recordings. Mm-hmm. Because Gregor had for decades met so many collectors, he was very well versed in how to talk to these people and recognizing what might be an entry point to be able to convince them if they're resistant or reluctant to give up something that
because
they
thought. Sometimes collectors are very reluctant to share what they have.
Anybody who has something that's prized and there's something, some commercial viability, nobody wants to get ripped off.
Right.
It's hard to
of
know
course.
Who to trust. And so Gregor and I went to Brooklyn. This man had us meet him at one of his friend's apartments. So of course we wouldn't know where he lived directly. And he walked in with this box of records and we started taking them out. And it was very clear immediately. Lepati had very distinctive handwriting and it was very clear from these labels. It was absolutely authentic. And the record label on those discs matched the record label on these other records. No guarantee that they were recorded at the same time, but in any case, it lent some authenticity to the fact that unlike that Chopin concerto, I think people are very now suspicious of any Lepati recording that's found, whether it's going to be authentic because of that particular case in the past.
People can put labels on anything and authenticate it.
Absolutely.
You know, that was the original fake news, I suppose.
We should be, of course, skeptical, and we should back up our discoveries. But Lepati's playing also is very distinctive, and there were people also when that, I'll just as a little sideline, when that Chopin concerto was being released, there were people who have very good musical training who heard that and they had their doubts and expressed their doubts as to whether that really was Lepati. But in this case, we spoke to this gentleman and Gregor said quite astutely, right now, these have autograph value and Lepati's autograph is fairly valuable. But the real value here is the music on those discs. But we have to get the music off those discs in order to be able to ascertain what the value is. And we're going tomorrow to visit this great transfer engineer. Perhaps you'd like to join us. You don't have to give up the records, of course, to people you don't know. But if you'd like to come in the car with us, we'll go. We can transfer them. Go right back. Mm-hmm. You can keep the tape. And so he was very upfront and also very much speaking to any potential hesitations this man might have. But of course, you know, it was the next day. It's quite logical that anybody should have other plans, and he wasn't able to join us. But I just said, perhaps, you know, you guys can keep in touch because Gregor goes there regularly. And if you don't mind, you know, I'll touch in with you occasionally and just see how things are going. And so he was quite open, but we knew that there might be some management that's required of this situation. In conversation, Gregor found out that this man would sometimes sell records to Academy Records in Brooklyn. And Gregor knew Joseph Gannon, who runs Academy Records. And so it was a good little connection in the sense that they knew that they had a friend in common, and the man seemed quite comforted by that. And when Gregor and I went downstairs, we were walking down the street, and he says, well, you know, this is really quite amazing and also quite worrying, because who knows if we'll be able to get these records. And one of the things that was clear at that point, at least one of the records, that the surface of the disc was peeling away. It was not a solid shellac disc like they usually are, but it was a metal plate that had the recording material on top of it, and it was already deteriorating, and it was clear that this record could not be played by normal means.
And one, it stands to reason that the others would deteriorate soon after.
Exactly. So we were quite concerned, and that was one of the things that we were trying to sort of use to tell this man that, you know, this needs to be done before too long if these records are going to be salvaged. Gregor was obviously quite concerned, and as we were walking down the street, he took out his mobile phone back in the day before smartphones, but it was a flip phone, as was very cool back then. And he phoned up Joseph and he told him, you know, that we just met this man, and perhaps if there was a way that he could vouch for us and for what we're doing, and that hopefully he could help coordinate and, you know, assist in this project. I would phone up this man in Brooklyn every few months, just try to encourage him, ask if he'd been to see Ward or been in touch with Gregor and so on. And, you know, he was always busy, he was traveling, he was doing something, there was always an excuse. And I also tried to tell him that once they're transferred, you know, I go to Japan every year a few times, and there are collectors there who would clearly pay top dollar, top yen for the autographs. And so, you know, he would, trying to encourage him to know that he would be able to get some money for these, but he was still reluctant, or at least non-committal, to getting the recordings transferred. And then eventually I just kind of dropped the matter after a year or two of phoning him every few months. And then a year or two after that, I get an email from Gregor saying, well, the guy's dead and we got the records.
Oh my goodness.
So what had happened was his widow contacted Joseph about what to do with these records in his collection.
And Joseph records. Knew what to do.
And Joseph knew what to do. So, you know, right. I'm very glad that I went with Gregor. Right. Had I not, who knows what would have happened to these. So Alan was the one who introduced us. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who went and introduced Gregor. Gregor connected with Joseph. And then it was just through this whole cycle. And so as I was saying earlier, there are several people who are involved and everybody had a really important role to play in getting these records into some hands that could take good care of them. But unfortunately, only 5 tracks were salvageable and several others were really, you know, just could not be played at all.
Tell me why these recordings are important.
When Lepati died, he left behind only 3.5 hours of recordings. So that's what his official discography was when he died, recording for the EMI label, and all recordings made from 1947 to 1950. And just on the basis of these few hours alone, he developed an international reputation as an exceptional interpreter. There's the precision of his playing, the beauty of sound, the transparency of voicing, where you can hear, if you imagine in an orchestra, you can recognize there's the flutes, there's the violins, there's the cellos, there's the oboe. The way Lepati played the piano, you can hear all these different elements of the musical structure equally clearly, as if it's a different instrument, although it sounds like, of course, the piano, but toned differently, in a sense, voiced differently. And he had this incredible command of technique to be able to do that and yet to make everything sound so easy. Also, he had a reputation of being a perfectionist, and all of his recordings are really note perfect, the ones that he approved for release. And even in the concert recordings, there are very few drop notes. There's like one wrong note in the Mozart concerto when he was deathly ill. And we hear a couple of more mild fumbles in his last recital where he was between pieces going to the artist's room at the back of the hall and receiving cortisone injections so that he could actually go back on stage. So he was unbelievably ill at the time. But because of the perfection technically and musically of his interpretations, as well as the vision that he brought, he seemed to almost be able to tap in directly, not just to the composer's desires, but to the, in a sense, the almost the source of the inspiration of what it is that inspired the composer. There's such profundity and depth and such a clear connection that even amateur listeners seem to recognize.
They could tell the difference.
They can tell the difference. And one story that I saw from in personal experience in my early years of hearing Lepati, I used to work at the A&A record store on St. Catherine Street in Montreal when I was a university student. And the first EMI CDs of Lepati's recordings had just been released, I think in the late 80s. And I put on Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, which was the It was a beautiful...
The Myra Hess transcription.
The Myra Hess transcription, which Lepati famously played and spent a lot of effort trying to get the perfect recording with the perfect voicing.
It was kind of his greatest hit in a way.
It was.
Like Glenn Gould's Goldberg variation.
Exactly. You know. And as it turns out, I later found out reading his biography that that was the first piece he played at his first recital in Paris in 1935, and it ended up being the last piece he played at his last recital in 1950. So it was really this leitmotif. And I put on the CD in the classical section where I was working at this record store, and every person who was in the store went up to see what was playing, and the CD sold out, the 8 copies that we'd had in stock, before the 3.5-minute piece was finished, which really communicated something extraordinary. It was so palpable that there was this depth and incredible musicality in what Lepati was doing, that it was that anybody who was listening would notice that. And apparently his teacher, Nadia Boulanger, who taught many famous musicians, said that as soon as Lepati sat at the keyboard and started playing, the energy of the room, the atmosphere in the room shifted completely, and that it was something so palpable and so clear to anybody that was there.
What I notice about these previously unpublished recordings that you've brought to light is that there's some repertoire that Lepati did not otherwise record. There are 2 pieces by Brahms. And
this is one of the fascinating things if we look at for pianists overall, and not just in Lepati's case, that what an artist will play in concert and what they might commit to recording in the studio can often be two very different things. And sometimes it might just be for commercial reasons that the label chooses certain repertoire because it will sell better, or another artist already recorded this piece that's in our catalog, so how about if you record this instead? And there are many cases historically of musicians who didn't record key aspects of their repertoire. Artur Schnabel, for example, who's famous for having recorded made the first complete recording of the Beethoven sonatas in the 1930s. There's not a single recorded note of him playing Chopin. And people can imagine now, because of his extensive recorded repertoire, we can't imagine him playing Chopin. And yet he did.
He played a lot of Chopin early in his career. I think later in his career, he limited himself to what he liked to call music that was better than could be played. Mm-hmm. But couldn't you say that about the Chopin barcarolle?
One absolutely could.
Or the Liszt Sonata, perhaps.
Absolutely.
You know, these are pieces that he was as famous for, if not more famous for, mm-hmm. back then.
But Edwin Fischer is another one who also played Chopin, and yet there isn't any recording of him playing that. And Myra Hess, who's so famous for the late Beethoven sonatas and Schumann Etudes Symphoniques and all these other works, you know, she only recorded 5 CDs worth of solo and concerto repertoire officially, and yet she played both Brahms concertos magnificently. Then there
well,
are,
we have live recordings.
There are live
of
recordings
those.
Of them, but anybody who hears those live recordings can absolutely be stunned that this is Myra Hess playing. So our perception of the artist is very often formed around what it is that they recorded commercially. And so, you know, fortunately, there are those labels releasing those bootlegs. And it was because I heard that Ravel recording of Lipati that I realized, well, you know, there might be other sides to his music making that's not represented in the bulk of his commercial recordings, and that's why I was so interested in exploring and finding some other things. So in these recordings, for example, we have 3 Scarlatti sonatas and these 2 works by Brahms, which, as you stated correctly, he didn't record any solo works by Brahms. He did record some Brahms waltzes for 2 pianos with his teacher, Nadia Boulanger. It was the first studio recording mm-hmm. he made when he was just shy of 20 years old, and they're wonderful, but no solo works.
Does Lipati play solo Brahms in concert?
Yes, he did. And in fact, one of the ways that we can ascertain that these recordings might be from the 1945-46 period is not just the fact that the label matches another recording which we know is dated from that period, but the works which we've been able to resurrect and salvage from these old discs were in his concert programs in the 1945-46 season.
Before we play these 2 Brahms performances, these recently discovered Brahms performances by Dinu Lipati, tell us what to look for.
Well, one of the things is, I spoke to earlier the reputation, in a sense, that Lipati had for perfection, but also because of his illness, he had Hodgkin's disease and he was too weak, as I said, in some concerts to play the full concert. Because of that, I think people imagined that he was always weak. And as I said, that one Ravel recording demonstrated that he wasn't. And in this series of recordings, especially in that Capriccio, Opus 116, number 7, we hear tremendous force and power. Even in the C major intermezzo, the Opus 119, number 3, a work which is often played a little bit more quaintly, and it's charming. It was one of Myra Hess's famous encores.
That was one of her greatest hits.
He has some really bold accents. He builds up to an incredible fortissimo in a way that's a little bit, I think, more passionate than most people would play, and that probably most people would expect Lipati to play.
Let's listen to Dinu Lipati play the Brahms Intermezzo in C major, Opus 119, number 3, followed by the Capriccio in D minor, Opus 116, number 7. pieces by Johannes Brahms, the Intermezzo in C major, opus 119, number 3, followed by the Capriccio in D minor, opus 116, number 7. In recently discovered recordings from the late 1940s by the legendary pianist Dinu Lipati, these are part of a small group of Lipati recordings that came to light about 10 years ago and have recently been issued for the first time. We have also been listening to an interview that I did with musicologist, scholar, and producer Mark Ainley. Just heard music by Frédéric Chopin. That was his waltz in A flat major, opus 42, from a 1950 studio recording by the legendary pianist Dinu Lipati. And also during this hour, we have been listening to an interview that I did with Mark Ainley, host of the Facebook page Mark Ainley's Piano Files, and also one of the world's leading scholars on the life and artistry of Dinu Lipati. We will hear more from my interview with Mark Ainley on a future episode of Between the Keys, which is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. This is Jed Disler, Artist in Residence for the Classical Network, and I look forward to us being together at this time next week for Between the Keys. Until then, stay well, be compassionate, and please, please, please be kind.